Squadron Leader Butler Eagle 2, I just asked you if the RAF regiment were protecting you in the airfields in Burma.
Yes, indeed, we had them protecting the airfield and our living quarters, which were tents, of course, and to the best of their ability, which was a very difficult job, considering that we're in jungle and the airfields were just strips cut out of the jungle.
How nervous did you feel about the closeness of the Japanese troops?
Well, obviously most uncomfortable, not knowing what they had in mind, and but we just had to live with it and accept the conditions.
Did they get close enough to fire into the camp?
Well, I suppose they must have done, but again, the memory isn't quite what it used to be. But we didn't have casualties anyway, not on the squadron, not by a direct Japanese action.
And 11 Squadron was flying the Hurricanes, was it?
Oh, yes, indeed. These were the only aircraft we had. And we were constantly flying. I remember on one occasion, clearly, I actually did 4 bombing trips in one day. And in the few months that I was with 11 Squadron, completed somewhere in the region of 140 operational trips, which when I completed my tour with 11 Squadron, I'd then done 304 operational trips before I was informed that I'd done enough, I suppose, and was due home, having been abroad for 3 years.
What was the quality of the individual Hurricane machines that you were getting?
Absolutely marvellous. I know I'm going back to the Battle of Britain now, but what a lot of people don't realise is that the Spitfire always gets the credit for the Battle of Britain, and yet the Hurricane shot down 60% of the German aircraft in the Battle of Britain. The Hurricane and the Spitfire had the Merlin engine, and perhaps the Spitfire just had a few more miles an hour, a little bit more manoeuvrability, but then again, it didn't carry bombs, which the Hurricane was able to do. And maybe I shouldn't say this, but for the last couple of months of the war, we were filling long-range tanks up with napalm, and the Japs didn't like that at all. And we were actually bombing Japanese troops within 50 yards of our own troops. And but our fellows fired smoke signals onto the Japanese, otherwise we'd never know where they were. But the Japanese caught onto this, and they, before we arrived on occasions, they fired smoke onto our troops. So we had to be on the target literally within seconds, otherwise we'd have bombed our own troops. And we had to ignore the Japanese. And also the smoke that our chaps fired onto the Japs coloured. The colours varied from day to day. And trip to trip, we were in constant touch with the commander of the troops, of course.
Was there any different flying technique that you had to adopt in dropping the napalm tanks as opposed to dropping bombs?
No, not really.
A different height?
No, it's usually the same. from about 8,000 feet, and sometimes less. It varied depending on the weather conditions, cloud and goodness knows what. Sometimes the weather was pretty awful, as you can imagine. But on the whole, we got over that all right and were able to fly as a squadron.
Did you have any accidents in which you hit our own troops?
No, not at all. We were very fortunate that way, I suppose. But what we invariably did, we, with myself being leader, would go in first. There'd invariably be 12 of us, and I would go in first. And then the 12th aircraft, Black 2, I'm red leader, of course, as soon as he's clear, Black 2 clear, and as his bombs exploded, I more or less went in with machine gun or cannon then, and we would make three runs each until we'd expended our ammunition, and then got out quickly and reformed and back to base.
How dangerous was the Japanese ground fire?
Well, I think they were too busy keeping their heads down. And they were troops, so they wouldn't be, they wouldn't have anti-aircraft guns or anything like that, I wouldn't have thought.
Did you ever set the jungle afire? Or was it too damp?
I would say it was too damp for that to happen, quite honestly. But I never remember it going up in flames. Otherwise, our own boys would have probably, being so close, would have had problems.
Were the individual Hurricane machines that you were getting clapped out machines that were dispensed with in Europe? Were they? Had they had lots of flying hours by the time you received them?
Well, all I can say is that we always managed to get 12 airplanes in the air, and if they had have been, and I've no doubt some of them were, then our chaps kept them in really good shape, because we always managed to get 12 in the air. Then I think we had about 20 on the squadron, so we were able to assemble 12 without a lot. Well, I say without a lot of trouble. The boys certainly worked overtime on the machines to keep them going. And the Hurricane, if it sustained damage, which we did obviously occasionally. Was a remarkably tough aeroplane. It was a canvas fuselage, which was useful, I'd have thought, as against metal. And bits and pieces did come off it occasionally. With a zero, we did experience a zero. But we could put the nose down, and even though we blacked out at times, we've known, as I mentioned earlier, that, that occasionally a Japanese aeroplane would disintegrate because they were rather fragile, was a zero. And I understand they didn't even have armour plating at the back of them, not that we were likely to get stuck into them to shoot those down, because we'd expended our ammunition anyway.
Did you ever get into dogfights with zeros?
Oh, no, not at all, no. We managed to avoid that. We would, I suppose, by surprise, we got in with our bombs first, and then carried out the rest of the mission, and then got back to base as quickly as we could. And as soon as we landed, I mean, we were refueled and rearmed again. As I mentioned to you, we, on one occasion, I did four trips in a day, and very regularly three. In fact, in the few months, as I mentioned to you, that I commanded 11, I think I did 140 altogether, operational trips.
How did you like being a squadron commander? And being
I enjoyed it very much indeed. I had a super bunch of fellows and didn't have a lot of trouble with them at all. No lack of moral fibre, as you asked me earlier. And they're only too keen to get airborne. And I treated them very fairly indeed. And if any discipline had to be dished out, well, they accepted it. And but very rarely did that happen, I'm pleased to say.
What type of disciplinary problems might crop up?
Well, it's a little bit difficult to say. Again, it's such a long time ago. At these reunions, I have to be reminded, you know, do you remember so-and-so, and, you know, overslept or something silly like that. Nothing serious, I promise you. No question of a court-martial, not to that extent. It was just a bit of a ticking off, and just to let them know who was the boss. And there was no question of being called George. I mean, like I insist they do call me now at the reunions, and we're all good pals.
So what did they call you, sir?
Oh, yes, indeed. Most certainly.
Presumably, out in the Burmese jungle, there was very little trouble they could get into anyway.
Well, that's true, yeah. There were no native young ladies or anything like that.
Did you have any contact with any Burmese civilians?
Very rarely indeed. There were so few villages, you know, that would hardly be able to exist, you know, in those conditions. As far as you could see, it was just jungle, and the Japs must just have carved their way, you know, and through and crossed the Irrawaddy River and a few other tributaries of the river, in sampans that they, you know what I mean by those, don't you?
Yes.
We shot those up occasionally with a few of them in, you know, anything that was going.
Did you often get big explosions from ammunition dumps that you'd hit?
Well, there again, I suppose they didn't have sort of huge concentrated piles, if you like, of ammunition. They'd just be dragged forward, and you know, from quite some distance way back. But just occasionally, we were fortunate and. But nothing massive or anything like that.
Did you know much about the individual British units that you were supporting in Burma, whether they were Chindits or what units you were backing up?
Well, on two occasions, I remember jumping into my jeep and driving down to the forward line, only 10 miles away, to meet General Musservi, and actually got into action with the army, which you know, I found most interesting, with my revolver and cookery, which the Gurkhas gave me, and also just to see what it was all about. And I will say this, that after every trip that we had done, we'd receive a signal from the front line within probably an hour to say, well done, 45 bodies found, right? And after every trip, and literally after I'd been, well, with 60 Squadron, although I didn't experience this not being the commanding officer, didn't have the same contacts as I did with 11 Squadron and the front line. But they said, well, look, sir, we'll certainly keep you informed. And again, I left these signals, these in the logbook that I had, but we did literally kill hundreds of Japanese, hundreds. In fact, I think it went into the over the 1,000 mark.
How do you know how you managed to contract this malaria and dysentery?
Even though I used the mosquito net, which was absolutely essential, and so on, but it's just one of those things that developed, I suppose, like so many of the chaps got, of course, which was part of the war and out there, and part of the conditions. Maybe the food, water, mosquitoes, of course, principally.
Do you still get the malaria today?
Yes, occasionally, yes. You know, violent shivers.
So were you dying to get out of Burma?
Oh, not necessarily. No, I enjoyed what I was doing, in fact. I really did. It might sound rather strange to say I enjoyed killing, but I thought, well, while we're here, we'll carry on with it. And I was most disappointed when I was posted home. I just wanted to carry on.
How did you get home?
Well, I received the signal, of course, and went across India to Bombay and came home by boat through the Suez Canal, landed at Liverpool and found the bloody dockers on strike, which pleased me immensely, I'll tell you. Particularly as I wanted to stay in the Royal Air Force, but I realised I had to reveal now that I'd started to wear glasses. And I couldn't have made it a career, for instance. But after I'd had a spot of leave, I went to the Air Ministry, and they sent me along to the Ministry of Information. And I was then seconded to the National Savings Movement and went round the country for almost 2 years, making speeches, and even from the London Palladium, the stage there, Tommy Trinder introduced me, but all over the country. But what I was saying about the dockers, I remember going up to Sunderland, and I think there were 4,000 fellows there, and I had to speak to them, and I told them what to do and jumped in my car and drove off.
What exactly did you say to
them? I'm not going to tell you, but it was rather naughty. Well, put it mildly, to bugger off, you know, but worse than that.
Were these dockers?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, having come into Liverpool and they were on strike and had to handle my own gear, and I think I was down to 9 stone by this time. The most I ever weighed was 11 and a quarter, so you can imagine what Burma did for me. But I thought at least they might have given us a hand off. But anyway,
so
that's another story, isn't it?
You felt it was an act of disloyalty?
Well, I felt so, because in Liverpool particularly, they knew most of the chaps had been out east.
What type of age do you think was most suitable for a fighter bomber pilot in the war? What would there be an age when people were really too old?
Well, I should say, that time, let me see, I'd be 25 then, when I left the squadron. And most of the boys, I should say, were between 21 and 26. There weren't many older than that.
What was the problem with people who were older flying in action?
Well, I think if you found in other theatres of war, you wouldn't find many of the boys over 30.
But was it a question of physical fitness or attitude or what?
I should say physical fitness. I think they would be keen enough. I'm just speaking of my own experience now. The chap is who I had the pleasure of commanding and flying with before 11 Squadron. Most of them were of that age.
But would you find that the younger ones would be more prepared to take risks?
I don't think so. I say, of the chaps I handled, they all seem keen enough. There's no question of, lack of moral fibre, not by any means.
Which time in the war was the best time for you, do you think, that you liked best?
Oh, despite the conditions, certainly the Far East, against the Japanese, with 60 and 11 Squadron. Excuse me, because there was far more action. We were constantly on the go and felt eventually that when we were driving the Japanese back and assisting the army, of course, that we looked like being on the winning side, which was rather nice.
Which was the worst time in the war for you, then?
Well, it's very difficult to define. When you say the worst time, did you mean the most dangerous?
That you disliked most?
I didn't dislike any of it at all. I enjoyed the war, I'll be honest with you. And I don't consider myself a hero by any means, but I just enjoyed what I was doing. And even though it involved killing, well, that's part of war, isn't it? And that's much we can say about it.
Then you were awarded another decoration in 1945. Can you tell me about that?
Well, this was after I'd got home, of course, and extremely delighted to be informed that I'd been awarded the Distinguished Service Order, or the DSO for the abbreviation. My wife Betty and I, a few months after that, went along to Buckingham Palace and were awarded both those decorations by the late King George VI.
Did you understand specifically what the DSO was for?
Well, I can only imagine for the number of operational trips I'd done and for the casualty inflicted on the Japanese and, I like to think, overall a decent job.
So that was really for the work that you did in command of
11 Squadron, yes.